The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
This week, my next guest ended his 22-year career working at the heart of TV3 and Virgin Media. A former ad man, Pat Kiley, has new plans afoot, and we'll get to those shortly. But first, Pat, you grew up in Newcastle, County Dublin. For anyone not familiar with the area, it's right on the Dublin-Kildare border. Were you Dublin or Kildare?
Very good question. We used to flirt with being Lily Whites every now and then. No, we were very much Dubs, but it was County Dublin, and I grew up. Newcastle was very much a rural village, an agricultural village. You know, the men standing outside the church with their hands behind their backs of a Sunday, the newspaper being sold outside the church. That, my memory growing up, was very much a small little village.
School-wise and all of that, you would have gone closer to the city into school then?
Yeah, I went to school in Clondalkin, a fantastic school, Moyle Park College. Funnily enough, the alma mater of Jim Gavin, who was actually a year behind me in school. So actually Jim and I would have played a little bit together. You know, we were the lads from out the country coming into school. I think every year there'd be three or four lads from Newcastle in the year, and that was it. But
they didn't call you Culshies in Clondalkin, did they?
There was probably other words, Richard, but probably now is not the time or the place to go into that.
But you used to play a bit of music. You knew Mick Christopher.
Yeah, funnily enough, back in the day, the one thing I particularly liked about Moyle Park was the trips to Rossmuck and the Gaeltacht. And Mick went to the Irish school in Clondalkin, and I got to know Mick. In fact, we spent a summer in the same house together.
So well for his... particular for the song Heyday and all of that.
Absolutely. Quite ironic that he went on, one of his songs went on to become a big soundtrack to one of Guinness's biggest, more recent advertising campaigns. You could see back then that Mick was a talent for the future, and I must say we all miss him dearly.
So you went into advertising. Was that something you'd thought about for a while? Was it accidental, or what was the plan?
Not quite. I wanted to be a journalist, and I applied for journalism in the old College of Commerce up in Rat Mines. For reasons that I'm sure I'd like to look back on in terms of leaving cert, I managed to get my second option as opposed to my first option. But therein lay a twist for me that proved to be a very advantageous one, because I absolutely fell in love with advertising and very quickly saw that advertising was a lovely crossover spot between business and science, if you like, and art and creativity.
So what was the advertising scene like at that time in Dublin? Probably very different to now. There would have been a lot of Irish agencies, some of which were taken over, but what was it like?
I have to say I was very lucky, Richard, because I think I came into the business probably just at the right time to see the last of, I guess, what we'd probably call now the Mad Men era of advertising in the late 80s. I got my first job in Doherty Advertising on Baggot Street in summer of 1988. Real iconic CEO there, Don O'Connell, who, you know, many of your listeners might remember in terms of being a big player in the Irish ad industry. Then went to an agency called O'Kennedy Brindley, which was at the time in 1989 then was bought by Saatchi & Saatchi. So here was I, a young fella starting out in Irish advertising. All of a sudden I'm working for Saatchi & Saatchi. It was an amazing experience. And Saatchi & Saatchi that year became the number one ad agency in Ireland. Terribly exciting period. Full service.
Was it Mad Men like, Pat?
Big characters.
Boozy lunches.
Well, I would say big character. I was the young fella in the office, so I wouldn't have seen much of that now, I can tell you. But I would have said, you know, there was definitely a lot of Don Drapers out there. Probably Donald Drapers, I guess. There was plenty of characters.
Donny Draper.
Yeah, plenty of characters, plenty of personalities. Extraordinary talent. You know, if you look back on bands and actors and people working at the highest level of business in Ireland, ad agencies proved to be the training ground of some amazing talent. So what I particularly liked was the model back then. It was full service agency. So at that time you had, a bit like Mad Men, you had the creative department, the media department, the client service folk, the planners, the researchers, all in the one office, all in the one building. Like, that was extraordinary energy.
Were there particular advertisements or ad campaigns you worked on that you look back on and say, oh yeah, that was quite good?
Oh God, good question. It was such a run, and I guess you're taking me back now. But look, I was very lucky. We got to work on, after Saatchi's, I went to an agency called DDFH&B, which was very much a startup. I think I was employee number 20, and it went on to become one of the biggest ad agencies, employed over 100 people. So we had Heineken as a big client was probably the biggest client I worked on and the biggest advertiser, Unilever, Nestle, Kraft General Foods. But more locally, we launched the Guardian Direct brand with 282820, which a lot of people might remember, the old Guardian Direct. And I remember sitting in the call centre, Guardian Direct, when that launched, since to become AXA, obviously.
Was the social life good? It must have been good crack. Like, even apart from social life, you know, work and people sitting around coming up with these ideas and coming up with slogans and planning it.
I guess, look, David Ogilvy had the old line, didn't he, that advertising is the greatest fun you could have with your clothes on. I think advertising is great fun. I think,
was it good for you?
In my period, I think the long lunches and the social aspect of it was starting to kind of dissipate, I have to say. I think it's an incredibly hardworking industry, but I think relationships are all important. So I think it's an industry that understands relationships and understands people and understands creativity. And that is where, I have to say, it is a lot of fun.
Now, the move into TV, it was TV3. How did that come about?
I was actually travelling back in January 98 on a long-haul flight. You know, I was 29 years of age. I'd been media director in DDF H&B for a couple of years. And believe it or not, I was thinking about what would be next. Like, you know, I think about that a lot more recently as to what the, you know, as a young guy, I was 2 years in a big job and I was thinking, what was the next move going to be? And I had this moment that I always think back on as being one of those kind of real affirmations. I took down, and it probably dates the story, because I walked down the cabin and took a Time magazine off the rack,
as you down would through have, first class pass,
as you would have done. Not at all. It was definitely back of the bus, and I was and I took it off the rack, and Jerry Seinfeld was on the cover, and I read this story about Jerry not renewing his contract with NBC. Through the article, there was one name kept being referenced, and it was the commercial guy from NBC. And I quickly realised the powerful connection between great content and great talent, but commercial support and ad revenue. And my head started spinning that, well, actually, being an ad man, maybe, and going back to that young fellow who wanted to be a journalist, maybe there's a connection that I could start to consider career-wise. Literally within days of getting off that long haul flight, James Morris asked DDF H&B to pitch for the TV3 business. And in the process of winning that business and agreeing to do TV3's advertising, I struck up a conversation with Rick Hetherington, the first CEO of TV3. And as these types of stories go, that conversation ended up with me agreeing to go in and be one of the launch management team and set up the commercial division of TV3 from the very start.
What was it like at the very start? I mean, it's any startup business, you got to do what you got to do to try and get things going. But this was the first real television rival to RTE. Was it seat of the pants stuff?
Scary, yeah, but terribly exciting. I went out, I always remember the first day out to Ballymount and stood in what at that point was an empty, you know, warehouse in Ballymount, and to be told that in 6 months' time this will be a national TV station and we'll be going live literally in 6 months' time. And I have to say, I probably spent a couple of days trying to really believe that. And we launched on September the 20th. And to be fair, on time, on budget, all the things that businesses want.
Was there an element of people writing you off at the start, looking down their nose, being a bit snobby, calling it Tala TV?
Look, I think that was all fair enough in terms of, you know, the rivalry that we all have within the business. I think that's a good energy.
You were sort of bringing mostly. On.
I think I look back and say that was, you know, part of the resilience that became part of the DNA working in TV3 and then subsequently Virgin Media Television.
And it has been quite a roller coaster. So, for example, when ITV invested, you would have got the rights to Coronation Street and all of that, which was really a tremendous boost for the business. And then not that long afterwards, UTV Ireland comes along and you lose those.
Yeah, and that sounds quite dramatic. I'll make it even a bit more dramatic. If we were putting a TV show together here, you've given me episode 3 and episode 5. There's an episode 4 in the middle here, Richard, which was the recession. So, and the sale of the business to a private equity house, Doughty Hanson. So just as we had survived the depths of the recession, yes, the ITV content contract expired, and that triggered the launch of UTV Ireland. And I think probably, Richard, that was the moment when most people wrote off the business and said, that's it now.
Did people say that to you at the time, Pat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, to my face. I went around town. I went to our top agencies and to the CEOs of all our top agencies, explained that we had a plan B. But I would say quite a lot of those guys would have said to me that day, Pat, this looks serious, doesn't it? And definitely a concern that this was the final blow.
Now, again, in more recent times, Liberty Global bought the business and it was rebranded as Virgin. Was that a difficult decision? TV3 had built up, you know, the brand, the reputation, was well liked, all of that. Is it difficult to say goodbye to a brand like that?
God, no. No. Well, firstly, I think bringing Virgin Media in as an investor and owner of the business is probably singularly the best move to have happened to the TV business in its now 22-year history. I think when I describe all those big challenges, if you notice, the recurring theme was the business being absolutely challenged and stretched at a time when the ad market would go into recession. That is not sustainable. That's not building a business to last for the future. And that needed to be addressed. And that is what Virgin Media has done as an owner, because I think COVID is a great example where the business has shown its resilience, but has shown that it's not now top of the list of potential casualties because the ad market has gone south.
Was there a downside to it at all? How did advertisers react to the change of name in Virgin Media?
Look, the focus of particularly the television side of the business is to bring advertising supporters and stakeholders with us. And you do that by bringing audiences with you. You know, eyeballs, you know, the money follows the eyeballs, the advertising support follows the eyeballs. So everything starts with thinking about the viewer.
So after 22 years, you were thinking about what you might do next. And I think you had announced earlier this year that you were going to be going. And there was speculation that you were going to become the chief executive of FAI.
I think there was other speculation about other roles as well.
Were you interested in the FAI job?
I talked at the time about a new challenge that I'm taking on in the autumn. I'm looking forward to talking more about that. I'm going to be moving into the entrepreneurial space, believe it or not, after 32 years of working.
FAI thing was fairly... one of the papers said that you were set to join as chief executive of the FAI. And I think at the time, you didn't exactly pour too much cold water on it. There was a statement issued saying you're not commenting beyond the press release about you going. And you said you're looking forward to a new challenge after a short break. Now, as a journalist, when I read that, that says, oh, yeah, that's true. He's going to FAI.
Yeah. Look, I think a lot of people made connections and I think there was an awful lot of probably assumptions that the fit felt right. But for
did
me,
you talk to them?
No, at no stage did I ever have a conversation with the FAI. And that's probably important to say that. So look, I've watched the FAI's fortunes with great interest. And in the space that I'm going into, I'd like to think that maybe my new venture and my new the new space that I'm going into might have some crossover opportunities, not just with the FAI, but maybe with other organisations. So I would say at best that's the space that I would see myself having any connection.
Tell me about the new venture. It's about advertising, but it's about content and it's about technology.
So the business that I'm looking forward to establishing and setting up in the autumn will be very much working with media investors, working with media owners, working with brands, working with talent. There are extraordinary opportunities in terms of opportunities to bring more investment into the content side of the business. The advertising industry is, you know, close to €1 billion industry. I think it would take a very small shift of that advertising investment to be pointed more closely to content. I think that's
so
something.
Does that mean then you would take marketing or advertising budgets for clients and use that then to find the right fit with content? Or is it actually where advertising drives the content?
There is a growing opportunity in terms of advertising, not just having to show up in the traditional space of the 30-second ad, that association of brands with content. There's a great growing, huge growth in advertiser-funded programming where brands are backing content by way of association rather than having to have just a logo slapped on at the start of the show or in the middle of the show.
And in terms of trends, Pat, is there a tendency now, I get a sense of this, that advertisers, what would have been traditionally advertisers, corporations, whatever, are looking at content and saying to TV channels or content providers, if you were to make a program that was about X, we would financially support that program. That happened with Love Island, I think, did it, where you had a commercial backing for the whole concept for the show, yeah, as opposed to the TV company saying, we're going to make a program about X, let's go and see if we can find a sponsor. You have the sponsor saying, why don't you make a program that's a bit like this?
Yeah, Love Island, what had been a format that had been on the shelves of ITV for years, and it was actually Group M Entertainment who played a part in bringing that show back to air, and Group M Entertainment is an advertiser-funded business out of one of the ad agencies. So again, you know, creative ways and creative thinking around how to bring content to life. And, you know, we've seen what that has done for Love Island and for ITV over the last number of years.
I can see that happening more and more, and I can kind of see the commercial logic of it for both sides. But as a bit of an old-fashioned traditionalist, is this the death of TV? Is this TV selling its soul?
Absolutely not. I think the challenge for TV and the challenge for traditional media is to look at new ways of reinventing itself, look at new ways of, you know, to collaborate and to partner with other parties, be that brands, be that sponsors, be that technology. I think the future looks bright for the media industry as long as it can work smartly with new partnerships, new collaborations, new technology. So that's a space that I'm very excited about working into the future.
RTE and Virgin Media, are they going to become greater collaborators or always rivals? There was an interesting article recently about RTE and Virgin Media, who had covered COVID best.
Again, I think that's good, healthy rivalry. I think competition is great, makes everybody up their game. I think both broadcasters did a fine job for viewers. I would say, certainly on the way out, my understanding was there was an awful lot of collaboration between the broadcasters for the greater good of the viewer. And that is a fantastic sign, because it's something I would have talked about for the last number of years, is the great opportunity for big broadcasters like RTE and Virgin Media Television to collaborate more. So I think we're starting to see it, and that's a great sign. And, you know, I wish both RTE and Virgin Media Television well with that, because I think that's definitely a big step in the right direction.
Well, Pat Kiley, best of luck with the new venture. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Richard.